while I was in session.
Good morning.
Apologize for the delay. I think everyone must have had a long weekend and trying to extend it. I don't blame you. We're going to proceed just as the agenda states, so I'm going to open the public hearing on House Bill 2912 and ask counsel to say a few good words.
Chair Ackerman, members of the committee, House Bill 2912 is basically a Religious Freedom Restoration Act, or RFRA. It's modeled after the federal act that was passed in 1993 and subsequently found unconstitutional as it applied to the states. RFRA is trying to bring back the standards the Supreme Court used prior to the Smith decision in 1990 in applying, as they decide free exercise of religion cases. That standard looks to the burden placed on the individual, the law of the burden placed on the individual, and then would apply strict scrutiny if it's a substantial burden. The standard that the courts currently use is to look whether the law is neutral and of general applicability. If so, they don't look to the burden that is placed on the individual's religious freedom.
Okay, thank you, counsel. I'll call. We have four witnesses to testify this morning, and I'll two for and two and against. So I'll bring the proponents up first: Bruce Fitzwalder and Dorothy Carmen. Good morning. Please state your name for the record.
Chair Ackerman, Judiciary Committee, my name is Dorothy Carmen. I'm with the Oregon Christian Home Education Association Network, a network of Christian home schools throughout the state of Oregon. I feel very inadequate to this task, very awed by the people that have already testified, and I'm sure that those that will come to testify as I am. I have no legal training. However, I have had the help of Homeschool Legal Defense Association, which is a group of constitutional lawyers that defend the right of families to homeschool across the nation. The Founding Fathers believed some rights were so important to the well-being of American citizens that they enumerated them in the first 10 amendments to the Constitution, the Bill of Rights. In the very first amendment, they listed rights that every American still holds dear: freedom of religion, freedom of speech, freedom of the press, and freedom to peaceably assemble and to petition government for redress of grievances, as we are doing today. As the nation grew and government regulations proliferated, it was inevitable that those regulations and our basic rights would eventually conflict. An example that directly pertains to homeschooling happened here in Oregon in the 20s. In that case, the Oregon legislature made a law that required all students to attend public school, period. A Catholic group, the Society of Sisters, families that had Catholic children, wanted them educated in the Catholic faith and in Catholic schools. That case, Pierce versus Society of Sisters, went all the way to the Supreme Court, and the U.S. Supreme Court found that the religious freedoms of those families could not be hampered by the general rule that all students must be in public school. And that is one of the foundational court cases for homeschool freedoms in the nation. So it is a very important case to us. For many years, the U.S. Supreme Court held that these First Amendment rights had special constitutional status, requiring the state to prove it has a compelling interest in order to burden an individual's rights to free exercise of religion. The state was also required to use the least restrictive means to fulfill its interest. Prior to 1990, the U.S. Supreme Court used the compelling interest test when deciding religious claims. However, in 1990, a decision, the Employment Division of Oregon versus Smith, and Oregon making waves again, the court tipped the scales of justice in favor of government regulation. The court threw out the compelling interest test, which had shielded our religious freedom from onerous government regulation for more than 30 years. The Smith decision reduced the standard of review in religious freedom cases to a reasonable standard. As counsel explained, if the law is generally applicable and is not targeting anybody, then the law stands and religious freedom does not trump it. In other words, if a state regulation is reasonable, and I know you try to make all your regulations as reasonable as possible, a religious objector loses. While all other fundamental rights, the freedom of speech, press, and assembly, etc., remain protected by the stringent compelling interest test, the court singled out religious freedom, reducing its protection to the weak reasonableness test. The compelling interest and the least restrictive means tests help level the playing field in the David and Goliath battle between the individual and the state. They prevent the proliferation of reasonable government regulation from running roughshod over the religious beliefs of individuals. When the standard of review was lowered to a reasonableness standard, the individual now had little recourse when his religion was burdened by government regulation. In 1993, Congress attempted to remedy the Smith decision by enacting the Federal Religious Freedom Restoration Act. This act simply restored the compelling interest test in religious freedom cases. RFRA attempted to use Congress's power under Section 5 of the 14th Amendment to require both the federal and state governments to use the compelling interest test in religious freedom cases. In the examples that I've given, Pierce versus Society of Sisters and the State of Oregon versus Employment Division versus Smith, these were Oregon laws that were examined by the federal government eventually in the U.S. Supreme Court. And so the standards, the compelling interest standard, did apply to state and local laws until the Smith case. Now, the Congress tried to put the standards back for both federal and state, and they used the 14th Amendment to do that. However, the Supreme Court struck down the state portion of the 14th Amendment of the RFRA in 1997 in the City of Bourne versus Flores. The problem addressed in that decision was not the compelling interest test. The test had been used, as mentioned earlier, by the U.S. Supreme Court itself for more than 30 years, and as I mentioned, in both federal and state cases. Rather, the Supreme Court ruled that Congress could not require states to use the test in religious freedom cases. In fact, RFRA is still in effect to protect individuals in cases where their free exercise is burdened by federal regulations. A widely recognized principle of law is that states are free to protect an individual's rights with a much higher standard than the U.S. Constitution itself affords. Under this principle and the Bourne decision, states are free to enact their own RFRAs, thereby choosing to apply the compelling interest test standard to their own religious freedom cases. House Bill 2912 does just that. It reestablishes on a state level the compelling interest test to balance the state interests against the individual's rights. This test requires the government to prove with evidence that its regulation is essential to achieve a compelling governmental interest and the least restrictive means of achieving the government's compelling interest. By enacting House Bill 2912, you will return free exercise to the same level of protection as other freedoms enumerated in the First Amendment. You will level the playing field, allowing individuals to defend their right to free exercise to their religion against the monolith of government regulations. You will not open government to a rash of religious freedom cases. In fact, these protections often provide impetus for negotiation, compromise, and accommodation between litigants. Page 4 of the handout I gave you lists some of the responses, answers the question, has it created increase in litigation? 12 states since the Bourne decision have passed Religious Freedom Restoration Acts, and in seven states, the courts have decided to reinstate the compelling interest. None of those states is experiencing an explosion of religious freedom litigation. You are not, by enacting House Bill 2912, you are not automatically providing a trump card to individuals. The courts have often identified compelling interests, and page 6 lists some of the compelling interests that the courts have already identified as the state having more interest in seeing these regulations carried out than the individual does to the free exercise of religion. And some of those cases include things such as maintaining a tax system and preventing discrimination based on race. There's a whole list of them, and again, this is just some of the ones that have already been identified. And by enacting House Bill 2912, you will not be creating new standards of protection for individuals. This is the standard which protected our free exercise of religion prior to 1990 in the Smith case, and this is the standard to which other rights in the First Amendment are currently protected. Dissenting in the minority on the Bourne case with Justices Breyer and Souter, Justice O'Connor stated that the court should have used the Bourne case to revisit the Smith decision of 1990, since Smith had so drastically redefined the standard of review of the Free Exercise Clause, departing from decades of Supreme Court precedent. O'Connor wrote, "The court's rejection of this principle in Smith is supported neither by precedent nor as discussed by history. The decision has harmed religious liberty. The historical evidence casts doubt on the court's current interpretation of the Free Exercise Clause." O'Connor gave a stirring review of the importance of religious freedom in our country. Quoting a number of state religious freedom charters, she noted that, "Early in our country's history, several colonies acknowledged that freedom to pursue one's chosen religious beliefs was an essential liberty. Moreover, these colonies appear to recognize that government should interfere in religious matters only when necessary to protect the civil peace or to prevent licentiousness." She further explained that every state constitution included the right to freely exercise religious beliefs. And she quoted James Madison in summary, explaining, "To Madison then, the duties to God were superior to duties to civil authorities. The ultimate loyalty was owed to God above all." Madison did not say that duties to the Creator are precedent only to those laws specifically directed at religion, nor did he strive to imply to prevent deliberate acts of persecution or discrimination. The idea that civil obligations are subordinate to religious duty is consonant with the notion that government must accommodate, where possible, those religious practices that conflict with civil law. O'Connor concluded, "It has long been the court's position that freedom of speech, a right enumerated only a few words after the rights to free exercise, has a special constitutional status. Given the centrality of freedom of speech and religion to the American concept of personal liberty, it is altogether reasonable to conclude that both should be treated with the highest degree of respect. The rule the court declared in Smith does not faithfully serve the purpose of the Constitution. Accordingly, I believe it essential for the court to reconsider its holding in Smith." Unfortunately, their dissent was ignored. It is now left to the states to stand up for religious freedom. You may wonder why you aren't hearing a general outcry from our churches, synagogues, and mosques. I hope you are, but I don't know. I believe it is because, as Americans, we believe that our First Amendment freedoms are all protected to the full and same extent, that free exercise and free speech are equally protected. Unfortunately, since the Smith case, it is not so. In closing, I'd like to read the First Amendment to the United States Constitution. "Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion, or prohibiting the free exercise thereof, or abridging the freedom of speech, or of the press, or the right of the people to peaceably assemble, and to petition the government for a redress of grievances. I urge you to protect freedom of religion for Oregon citizens to the same standards as other freedoms enumerated in the First Amendment. Please pass House Bill 2912.
Thank you. Mr. Fitzwalter.
Thank you, Chairman Ackerman. I represent, my name is Bruce Fitzwater. I'm from Portland. I represent the Christian Science Churches in Oregon, and I want to go on record in support of House Bill 2912. Joining with the Catholic Conference, the Methodists, the Seventh-day Adventists, and other religions. I won't. I have no written testimony, and I'll just say a few brief words in support of the bill. I think that the spirit of a people, their underlying attitude towards their government, often reflects that government's attitudes towards them, and that by passing 2912, we are ourselves as a society, as a government, valuing individuals, encouraging their spiritual development and lives. And I think that encouragement and recognition will be supported with just a greater sense of the wholeness and health of the community.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Are there questions from the committee?
Mr. Chair, I do have a question. Ms. Carmen, you indicated that you represented a homeschooling organization. Is there anything about the current requirements applicable under Oregon law to homeschools that you think that would be, if this law were passed, this bill would then be a basis for challenging those sort of requirements that are currently applicable?
Chair Ackerman and Representative McPherson and committee, under the current homeschool law, I do not believe there are any religious burdens placed on homeschool families. I do not know, I cannot speak obviously for all homeschool families. The current homeschool law requires us to notify and to test in grades 3, 5, 8, and 10.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Further questions from the committee? If not, thank you again for your testimony, and you're excused at this time, and I'll call up the next two witnesses, Ms. Meyer and Ms. Monson. And Mr. Auerbach, I'm sorry, I missed your name, but you're here and that's fine.
Good morning. Good morning, Chair Ackerman, members of the committee. Andrea Meyer, Legislative Director for the ACLU of Oregon. Now, I may have misunderstood Representative Hunt when he spoke here last time, but I thought he said that everyone behind him would be testifying against it represented government entities. And I want to assure this committee that the ACLU is not a government entity. Indeed, we most often sue governments. So it's a little broader scope. The ACLU historically supports legislation providing strong protection of religious exercise, even against neutral, generally applicable government restrictions. Indeed, I think you heard about the Seventh-day Adventist case in Oregon. The ACLU represents the students in that case against the Oregon School Athletic Association. And in the Sunnyside matter that you also heard about, although we did not get involved in terms of any legal representation, we also wrote a letter to the city council expressing our deep concerns about that. Unfortunately, the matter was resolved. But we are also concerned that courts may turn a state statutory shield for religious exercise into a sword against state and local civil rights laws. It is important to ensure that any state legislation enhancing the protection of religious exercise will not cause any unintended harm to the enforcement of state and local civil rights laws. Thus, the ACLU regrets that we have no choice but to ask that this committee refrain from passing House Bill 2912 or any religious liberty legislation unless it will not have any adverse consequences on the hard-won civil rights laws enacted and enforced by state and local governments. Let me give you a bit of history. The ACLU is one of the founding members of the coalition that supported the 1993 Federal Religious Freedom Restoration Act, often referred to as RFRA, which was subsequently held unconstitutional. And initially, we supported the Religious Liberty Protection Act, RLPA. It doesn't have an acronym that comes trippingly to my lips. That was proposed next. However, we, along with the Religious Action Center of Reformed Judaism, the Anti-Defamation League, the National Council of Churches, the Presbyterian Church, the Episcopalian Church, the National Council of Jewish Women, the United Church of Christ, and the NAACP concluded that we could not continue our support for the Religious Liberty Protection Act because of the potentially severe consequences that this law would have had on state and local civil rights laws. Although we believe that courts should find civil rights laws compelling and uniform enforcement of those civil rights laws the least restrictive means, we know that several courts have rejected that position. We have found landlords across the country using state religious liberty claims to challenge the application of state and local civil rights laws protecting persons against marital status discrimination. None of the claims involved owner-occupied housing. All the landlords owned so many investment properties that they were outside the state law's exemptions for small landlords. These landlords all sought to turn the shield of religious exercise protection into a sword against civil rights of prospective tenants. The U.S. Court of Appeals for the Ninth Circuit in Alaska case, Thomas versus Anchorage Equal Rights Commission, applied a strict scrutiny standard of review to a local civil rights law in a challenge that the law burdened the landlord's religious beliefs. As the court wrote, quote, "We must decide whether the enforcement of Alaska's housing laws prohibiting apartment owners from refusing to rent to unmarried couples infringes Christian landlords' rights under the free exercise clause of the First Amendment, unquote. The court held that it did. A year later, the decision was vacated on procedural grounds, not the merits of the decision. If the Ninth Circuit reasoning in that case is followed, a Roman Catholic landlord might be able to refuse to rent to Catholics who favor allowing priests to marry. An Orthodox Jewish landlord might be able to refuse to rent to Jews who do not keep kosher. At issue here are local and civil rights laws that protect persons because of characteristics such as marital status, familial status, pregnancy status, sexual orientation, disability, and religion itself. In these cases, landlords or employees could argue that it would violate their religious scruples to rent an apartment or hire a person who participates in activity that violates their religious views. If this committee is considering moving House Bill 2912, then this bill needs to be amended to exempt state and local civil rights laws from coverage under this bill. That way, we are assured that there will be no unintended consequences to this legislation. The ACLU of Oregon believes that House Bill 2912 is unnecessary in light of the Oregon constitutional protections and federal legislation. I wanted to quote briefly from a 1995 Oregon Supreme Court case, Medelbecky, in which the court discussed, and just to refresh this committee's memory, instead of just the First Amendment of the U.S. Constitution protecting religion, we have seven amendments relating to religion in our Oregon Constitution. And I'll read only two. Article 1, Section 2 states, "All men shall be secure in the natural right to worship Almighty God according to the dictates of their own conscience." Article 1, Section 3 provides, "No law shall in any case whatever control the free exercise and enjoyment of religious opinions or interfere with the right of conscience." I quote the court one more time. "These provisions are obviously worded," said the court, "more broadly than the federal First Amendment and are remarkable in their inclusiveness and adamancy with which rights of conscience are to be protected from government interference." In 2000, Congress passed the Religious Land Use Institutionalized Persons Act. This one has a good one, RLUIPA. The ACLU and the numerous organizations that oppose the Religious Liberty Protection Act supported passage of RLUIPA. In fact, the ACLU helped draft this federal law. It was supported by more than 60 groups, including the Family Research Council, the Baptist Joint Committee, the Christian Legal Society, the American Jewish Congress, and Christian denominations ranging from Catholics to Mormons to Seventh-day Adventists, and yes, again, the ACLU. RLUIPA addressed our concerns about civil rights protections while at the same time identifying the areas of most concern: land use, zoning and historic preservation, and institutionalized persons, prisons. Indeed, according to the National ACLU, RLUIPA has been widely and successfully used. The law has been challenged, and the case, Cutter v. Wilkinson, is before the U.S. Supreme Court. The court heard oral argument last month and will decide on its constitutionality by June. The ACLU filed an amicus in that case, urging the court to uphold the federal law. Most of the groups I hear back who were involved in the case feel confident the Supreme Court will uphold its constitutionality. We believe that federal law and Oregon Constitution more than adequately addresses the concerns that House Bill 2912 seeks to address while not undermining state and local civil rights laws. The ACLU urges this committee not to proceed with House Bill 2912 as drafted. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Next. You're pointing to each other, so want me to break the tie?
Christie's direction, I'll go first. Chair Ackerman, members of the committee, my name is Harry Auerbach. I am a chief deputy city attorney for the city of Portland. Thursday, my colleague Pete Casting, our other chief deputy, was here and did not have an opportunity to testify in the time the committee had. So his written testimony has been submitted to the committee, and I'm not going to repeat it. I'd like just to make a few observations that I hope will be of assistance to you in your deliberation of this bill. The first thing is, and I think we pointed this out when a similar bill was before this body last session, there doesn't appear to be an actual problem that this bill is designed to solve. That is, I haven't heard, and I don't think the committee has, but I wasn't here on Thursday, of any current significant problems that people of faith are having with generally applicable state or local regulations that require the intercession of the legislature through passage of this bill. The examples that I heard this morning included an 85-year-old case in which the religious rights of the individuals were ultimately vindicated, and the Smith case that was decided 15 years ago in the Supreme Court. All I can say, frankly, about the Smith case is that I think it was to some extent an aberration because of the nature of what was at stake, which was the issue in the case was whether the state of Oregon could deny unemployment benefits to a person who was fired from his job as a drug counselor for taking peyote, which he claimed was a religious sacrament. And I think that the presence of the drug element in the case made it hard for the Supreme Court of the United States to say that the state was required to give unemployment benefits under those circumstances. But that was, again, was 15 years ago, and we haven't seen a parade of discrimination against religious conduct through state and local regulation that we would submit requires the passage of this bill. I would also suggest that religion is not treated differently in the formulation of the First Amendment jurisprudence than speech. There are cases from the United States Supreme Court that set out essentially the same test for the application of generally applicable regulations that are not targeted at speech but have some impact on people's speech. And there are cases like Erie versus Pabst AM where the Supreme Court used that generally applicable test to uphold regulations of nude dancing, or State versus O'Brien, a similar case. And in cases such as Ward versus Rock against racism, we have the test set up for government regulations which do directly impact speech in time, manner, and place restrictions. And that they use a test that is similar to what is currently used to judge the permissibility of enforcing generally applicable regulations that may affect some people in the exercise of their religious activities. What I submit are some of the dangers of a bill like this are the unintended consequences. And with respect to Ms. Meyer, whose opinion I greatly respect, I don't think that you can eliminate the unintended consequences with any amendment because they will require interpretation of things like what is a substantial burden on religion. And what I fear, frankly, about the formulation of testing what a substantial burden on a person's exercise of religion is it will get the government involved in precisely what the government shouldn't be involved in, which is deciding what is religion and what is legitimate religion and what is a substantial burden on somebody's exercise of their religion. And these are places where the government really ought not to tread at all. And the last thing I'll point out to you is I know that frequently in these conversations the subject of our experience in Portland with the Sunnyside Methodist Church comes up. And I want to say just a couple of words about that. First of all, of course, it was a land use case, and the land use is expressly exempted from this bill. But the real point is the issue that people had with it was a condition that was proposed by the land use hearings officer in renewing the conditional use approval, which would have limited the number of people that could have attended, been in attendance at any one time at the church. And that was a bad idea. And if that thing had proceeded to go to the Portland City Council, there's absolutely no way that the Portland City Council would have kept that requirement in there because everybody knew that requirement was unreasonable and unconstitutional, and it wasn't going to be part of any final decision. But my real concern is what we really try to do at a local level is not is solve problems. Okay, and what I did personally in connection with the Sunnyside Church is I was given the task by the City Council to try to bring the church folks and their neighbors together to resolve the issues that created the need for that land use decision in the first place. And those were issues around the impacts of the church's feeding programs on the neighborhood. What I am concerned about is that a bill like this will make it harder for local governments to solve problems by bringing people together, because we won't be able to rely on generally applicable regulations in order to make the church folks come to the table. It was a remarkable experience to be involved in that conversation, because ultimately one of the things the church people realized was that part of their faith was to be good neighbors, and they were able to achieve a resolution with their neighbors that helped them accomplish that and be not only better neighbors but in their own eyes better Christians. Without the generally applicable provisions to bring them to the table, that wouldn't have been able to happen. So that would be my parting message to you again, is I don't see a problem that calls for this bill. The bill will have unintended consequences, and it will make it harder for us in local government, certainly, to do our core job, which is to help people solve their problems. And I thank you for your attention.
Thank you.
To answer any questions.
Ms. Monson.
Chair Ackerman, members of the committee, my name is Christy Munson, representing 240 cities in Oregon, League of Oregon Cities. I'll only take about 3 or 4 minutes to give testimony without repeating anything that's been said. I just thought there'd be a couple things that this committee should know about this bill. What this bill does not do, this bill does not just affect local civil rights law. This bill does not just shift a burden from the burden on the people challenging law to the government. It is a major change in the way courts review local government and state government legislation. And what it says is this: a city cannot substantially burden free exercise of religion by applying any law of general applicability without satisfying the highest judicial standard that you could satisfy. What does that mean? Everybody's been talking about rules of general applicability. That's lawyer speak. What it means is general rules that apply to everybody. What kind of rules are those? Those could be noise ordinances, curb cut allowances, sign ordinances, traffic regulations, sanitation ordinances, parade permits, daycare licensing, you name it. Rules of general applicability. And what this standard would do is set a very, very high hurdle for those general rules that should apply to everybody. And that hurdle would have to be met when a group claiming a religious affiliation says that those rules of general applicability are burdening their free exercise. I've given you a couple examples in here, and you're free to read them, but what you should know is that if somebody's claiming that they have a religious affiliation, and you've burdened that religious affiliation through, say, not giving a curb cut to their place of worship so cars could get in and out better, What the standard will now be is that the government will have to show, one, a compelling interest that you didn't give that curb cut, and two, that you tried to do it through the least restrictive means. Right now, the standard is, hey, it was rational. We looked at traffic safety. We didn't think this was a good curb cut, and so we're using a rational basis. Now they're going to have to show, did you do everything you could have in order to not burden religion? And those examples can be used throughout noise ordinances. Especially important, a lot of religious groups have daycare facilities. Regulations regarding daycare facilities that are generally applicable would then be subject to this, what's called strict scrutiny test. So that's the true effect of this. And that's why local governments are very concerned, because right now we believe that laws that are not that are fairly applied and that general applicable should not be subject to such high standards. Already, they're subject to high standards for stuff such as racial discrimination. But religious affiliation is a very tough nut to crack, in that it's not facially, it's not on its face, something that you can determine. Again, the bill itself says it doesn't, if somebody's claiming religious affiliation and, for example, let's say they're singing at night and it's disturbing the neighbors, that singing doesn't have to be central to their belief even. It doesn't have to be a central tenet of their belief in order to gain this additional protection. So it's a very, very broad rule with very broad application. Lastly, we just wanted to mention two things. The fiscal impact, we haven't heard a lot about that. We believe it will open cities, school districts, counties, state government, special districts, you name it, to increase liability, and it will have a fiscal impact. We cannot quantify that at this time, but it will have a fiscal impact. And lastly, one thing that government people in government know, but it's not easily recognizable, is that any law that you pass that would favor one group over another will initiate lawsuits, because the other group that is not favored will be suing us. We are bound by law not to favor religion also. And so when we take away regulations as applied to religious affiliates, non-religious people in that neighborhood who said, hey, you know, you applied a noise ordinance to me and now you're not going to apply it to that church, they're going to sue us for under the anti-establishment clause, not establishing church. So I'd be happy to answer any questions, and thank you for your time.
Thank you. Questions from the committee?
Chair Ackerman, I'm sorry, I forgot to mention one thing. I was asked by the Association of Oregon Counties to let you know they also have concerns.
Fine, that's noted. Thank you very much. And back to questions, Council.
Ms. Meyer, you indicated that the Oregon Constitution was more protective of religious freedom than the federal Constitution. Do you know what standard the Oregon Supreme Court currently applies to free exercise cases?
Chair Ackerman, members of the committee, Mr. Sears, I haven't had a chance to quickly look at that. It's too bad Stephen Green isn't here, and I don't know if you have. There aren't that many cases under Article 1, Sections 2 and 3. So the case law is little, but maybe someone else has. I think the note being written, and I think I will repeat it, is that there is, we haven't seen a problem, and when it's necessary for us to use it, we believe it's there to use.
Further questions from the committee? I just had a general question, and I should have asked it when the other folks were up here, but perhaps somebody could supplement the record by giving the committee a letter on this. But the question I have is whether there is already an adequate remedy under federal civil rights laws, particularly Title 42, Section 1983 of the United States Code, which is applicable against states and involves the violation of constitutional rights, which can be alleged by any United States citizen. I don't need to get into an extended discussion of that because this is sort of a surprise question, but I know both proponents and opponents have legal representation, and I'm willing to hold the record open to hear from you in writing, maybe one or two page letters, to whether that remedy is adequate for the objectives sought in House Bill 2912.
Chair Ackerman, members of the committee, with your indulgence, I think I can answer your question. And I think the answer is yes, that the federal remedy is adequate. I think part of the reason that we don't see a lot of cases brought under the Oregon Constitution is because people do rely on the federal statute. And in our experience, they do bring cases. So that would be my answer, is that I think existing remedies are adequate to protect.
Well, I just want to give both parties an opportunity to respond, and if anyone wants to, again, send me a note in the mail, I'll make sure that it's distributed to committee members before we have further action on the bill and be considered as a part of the record.
Chair Ackerman, members of the committee, I just want to reiterate, because I don't want us to lose track, we now have a federal law, RLUIPA, that covers much, if not all, of the areas that have been problems. And that's why ACLU and that whole broad group that came to agreement, and that's what Congress passed, which is the land use and the prisons. That applies to the states. That is covers, again, the majority of the area. So we have protections. I just don't want us to lose sight of the protections that the federal law has now imposed. And as I said, we're quite confident it will be upheld by the courts, unlike RFRA, the original one, that was not upheld. So I think we've got relief that we need, and it's unnecessary in light of that to really proceed.
Anyway, I'll still leave it. The record's still open on that point. You folks may submit letters on it to help us out.
Appreciate it.
Thank you very much for your testimony.
Thank you.
Any further witnesses on House Bill 2912?
Mr. Chair.
Sir, you're raising your hand.
Can I come back and make a few comments?
Yes, you may. I'd like to have them brief. I have four more bills to get through this morning in less than in an hour and a half.
Mr. Chair, do you have another one?
Yes, please come forward.
Thank you, Chairman Ackerman. Bruce Fitzwater from Portland, representing the Christian Science Churches. The issue of of people being not needing this bill. I would like just to give you an informal account of an experience that happened about a year ago. A woman in Portland who did basically house cleaning for a Christian institution was unemployed because of the dissolution of the institution. And she applied for unemployment, and she took several jobs and was working with her unemployment. She was offered a job in a fine place, but it was in contradiction to her spiritual standards. It wasn't her concept. She was taken off unemployment because she had refused this job. Now, she was actually working at the time for a temp agency. This is a person of very modest means, but she was offered a job that violated her religious conscience, and she said, no, I can't do that job. They looked at it and said, no, well, if you don't do the job, you're off. And so she was on the point of taking back, having to give back her unemployment. And I talked with her several times and asked her if she wanted help on this, and she just didn't want to make a big deal out of it. And I think that someone else very well could have taken that job. The state wouldn't have been on unemployment. This woman is not trying to take the state's money. That I feel that the state people should have been sensitive to the fact that she had a serious religious objection to this. It could have been established very clearly from her record. It wasn't, you know, she would go on to do other jobs, but she shouldn't have had lost those months of unemployment. Now, I think the state should be sensitive to people like that. And I think this bill is about that. And there are lots of little cases like this that maybe don't show up because we don't have high-priced lawyers to support it. But these are the kinds of things that I think would put the state on record to say we need to be sensitive about these issues. Thank you.
Thank you.
Chair Ackerman, members of the committee, for the record, Robert J. Castagna, representing the Oregon Catholic Conference. You would think from the testimony you heard from the previous witnesses that House Bill 2912 invented a new legal standard. House Bill 2912 does not invent a new legal standard. House Bill 2912 returns us to a standard that existed before Employment Division versus Smith. These 12 states that have passed state-level Religious Freedom Restoration Acts, according to the information that has come to my attention, have not experienced a plethora of litigation suing on the basis of the state Religious Freedom Restoration Acts. I might want to emphasize and repeat for the record that the ACLU was a sponsoring member and supporting member of the Religious Freedom Restoration Act that Congress passed in response to the Employment Division versus Smith case. And in response to the testimony of the City of Portland, I am quite amazed that a representative of the city would say that the churches would not come to the table, being a good neighbor, to resolve and to discuss a legitimate dispute. The hearing officer's opinion in the Sunnyside Methodist Church made national and international news because a land use hearing officer for the City of Portland attempted to limit the number of people that could attend a church service. It was not only ridiculous, it was unconstitutional. I think the churches in the City of Portland have a good enough working relationship that if there were a dispute, both sides would willingly come to the table. But as I testified on behalf of Sunnyside Methodist Church's representative last week, Paul Cosgrove, in the United Methodist Church, the issue was not that the church ultimately prevailed. The issue was that the church had to go to tremendous effort and tremendous legal expense to uphold its rights. We shouldn't have to do that to uphold fundamental constitutional rights. We ask you to pass House Bill 2912. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Any further questions from the committee? Yes.
For Mr. Fitzwater, if I could.
Now that you've opened the door, you've got to come back.
Okay. Sorry. Well, just since we had an example of a live, apparently fairly current case, what was the nature of the employment that was offered to the woman who declined it?
Right. And this is the... let me just preface this. This woman was a Christian Scientist, and as such, she relied on spiritual means for healing. And in this case, she did not want to be involved with a medical establishment. Now, let's realize she did not have a sense that this was a bad thing. It just was not her position. And it seemed to me almost perverse to say, all right, here you've been working for a church institution that has certain values. Go and work for this other place. Oh, you're not going to do that? no money for you. You put all your money, you've been contributing for years into unemployment. And we could imagine some kind of situation where all you'd have to offer is someone who had a restriction against, let's say, abortion or whatever. You want the job in the clinic? No? Well, then you get qualified for it. You're out of unemployment. That's how the system seemed to work. She appealed it. She didn't go to the, whether it's constitutional or not, I have no idea. But this is a simple working individual who's simply trying to get by.
That's all I had.
Thank you. That clarifies the record for us. Thank you very much. A further testimony on House Bill 2912. Hearing none, then the public hearing on House Bill 2912 is concluded. And I'll open a public hearing on House Bill 3124. Council, tell us about this bill.
Chair Ackerman, members of the committee, House Bill 3124 and the Dash 1 amendments do several things. Most notably, they extend a sunset on a court surcharge fee for an additional 18 months. In the 2003 legislative session, House Bill 2759 caused a 30% increase on certain court fees that was set to sunset July 1st of this year. And this bill would extend that sunset for 18 months. It does several other things. It exempts most municipal, county, and justice courts from collecting these fees and distributing them to the Judicial Department operating account. It increases respondents' fees. It increases from $4 to $7 the amount a clerk may charge for the writ of execution of garnishment. It increases the amount of court that the court may award for certain prevailing party fees, and it also modifies provisions relating to justice courts in Deschutes County.
I have three witnesses, Mr. Bieda, Mr. Linden, Mr. Marquis. Please come forward. Again, I'd like to remind you all that we have four bills left, and we have an hour and a half to hour and three quarters at the max. So I'd appreciate if you could tell your testimony accordingly so we can hear all the bills today. Gentlemen?
I'll go first. It won't take long. My name is Anthony Bieda, and I represent Lane County in front of the Oregon Legislature, specifically to the Dash 2 amendments, which you have not heard explained yet. It's a simple two-line deletion on page 21 of House Bill 3124, lines 5 and 6, by amending that provision in the bill so that the law library fee collected by the clerks of the court would in fact continue at a level prior to the 2001-2003 biennium. The Lane County Law Library would be able to continue to participate in the growth in fees that go to fund the County Law Library in Lane County. We in Lane County do not fund our County Law Library, which is a public information facility, with County General Fund. It is strictly supported by the fees generated by the court fees. And to the degree that that court fee has been capped, that has constrained the ability of us to provide the services that we think are demanded as the filings ebb and flow in Lane County. So that is specific to that amendment, and I'd be glad to answer any of the questions.
Fine, we'll go through the panel first. Mr. Marquis or Linden.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the subcommittee. Jim Marquis, representing the Oregon Collectors Association. As your learned counsel explained, last session, the business community came together and along with the Oregon State Bar and others and developed a program that created a 30% surcharge on court filing fees, all court filing fees, for a period of 2 years, and then that 30% surcharge dropped off to a 10% permanent increase, and the surcharge currently under current law ends June 30th, 2005. This was an effort to raise money to keep the courts open as they were somewhat in crisis stage at that point. That was a kind of a two-year deal, and it was supposed to come off. The courts are still kind of hurting for money, so we got together with some folks and created this program that is in the House Bill 3124 with the Dash 1 amendments, and it would continue the 30% surcharge until January 1 of 2007. That raises about $5 million for the courts. That money is in both versions of the co-chair's budget, and we've met with the co-chairs about doing what we're doing here, and they fully support what we're doing, and would like to see this bill get down to the Ways and Means so they could move it forward. In addition to the 18-month extension, we did exempt justice and municipal courts going forward. There are only about three of these fees that would be paid by those courts, and it was simply, I don't think the intent really in the bill originally 2 years ago was to have them pay those fees, but they did get collected, and so they're exempt going forward. We did increase the prevailing fees in small claims on a default from $60 to $75, if you go to hearing from $85 to $100, and in circuit court on a default from $250 to $275, and at trial $500 to $550. The co-chair's desire was to include the provisions of House Bill 2305 in this bill. You already passed 2305 down to them separately, and that's the bill that increases the fee for issuing a writ of garnishment from $4 to $7 and increases the recoverability of such writs by the same amount. They just felt it would be good to have all of this in one bill, so asked that that be put in here. And then we increased answer fees by 10%, and we're still waiting for figures as to how much that will increase funding for the courts. The 2305 raises about a little over $200,000 for them. So, and then Mr. Linden has a couple of other provisions that he'll describe. So with that, Mr. Linden.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, Bill Linden, I have two clients with an interest in this legislation, so I want to be very clear about identifying what those interests are. I represent the Circuit Court Judges Association. And with the exception of Section 97, on which the Circuit Court Judge Association has no position, that's the Deschutes County Justice Court piece, I'm speaking on behalf of the Judge Association on the balance of the bill. What I wanted to stress were just a couple of things. Number one, in 2003, there was a very well thought out and inclusive process for all the interested parties to come together and talk about filing fee surcharges in the circuit courts. And the 2003 legislation did result in a surcharge that all the parties signed off on. That surcharge generated revenues that indirectly came back into the judicial department in terms of financial support from the general fund. The Dash 1 amendments reflect an extension of that compromise and those negotiations, and again would provide 18 months worth of financial support, again indirectly through the general fund, for the judicial branch in the state. The court budget was cut in the governor's proposed budget by about $24 million. So the $5 million that is generated here is a reasonably small but important piece of restoration. In addition to that, the co-chairs have also identified other general fund resources that they intend to devote to judicial branch functions that would be complemented by the revenue raised by these amendments to the House Bill 3124. And again, there's a little bit in here for everybody to like very much, and a few things in here that people may quibble about, but by and large, it is the effort of continued discussions and compromise and agreement for how we might generate some additional general fund revenues for one of the branches of our state government. In Section 97 of the bill, there is authority provided to Deschutes County to operate a justice court within the city limits of Bend. They would be joining eight other counties east of the mountains that have authority to have a justice court operate in the county seat. And the Deschutes County interest in this is they want to be able to keep open the possibility of consolidating court services with the city of Bend. Right now, the county operates a justice court in three locations in the county. The city of Bend operates a municipal court within the city of Bend. And this would leave open the door for the possibility of a consolidated court system, lower court system, that would handle primarily traffic and some small claims generated, the traffic cases generated by the municipal and the county law enforcement teams. And one of the provisions we've added here, you'll see, which was important to the circuit court over in Bend, was that this justice court not be located in the county court, in the circuit court facility. And so there's a provision in there that provides it will be separate from the circuit court facility. And that's important because the counties are still responsible for providing facilities, and they do not want to mix the courts together. So that's what Section 97 does. And like I say, the circuit judges don't have any position on that. The Circuit Judge Association has no position on that piece. There's some disagreement about the fiscal impact of doing this. We don't happen to think there's any. Others think there is some. But we expect that will all get sorted out in the Ways and Means process. So our request to you is to take a look at scheduling this for work session, adopting the Dash 1 amendments, and moving along in the process to the Ways and Means Committee.
And Mr. Chair, with respect to the Dash 2 amendments, I think the with regard to law library fees, 2 years ago we negotiated very, very carefully who would pay what fees and where they would be distributed, and there were adjustments made to the law library fees at that time, and I believe we would be opposed to any further change at this time, so we would not support the adoption of the Dash 2s.
Ms. Chairman, I would only add, I believe that within these 100 pages of amendments, there is a provision that would continue the law library fee surcharge at the same level for this 18-month period coming up as it's been in place for the past 2 years. Now, there still may be an issue about that sunsetting on December 31st of 2006, but I do believe that there is a continuation of the current level of law library fee within the Dash 1 amendments, but we think we can verify that and get back to the subcommittee prior to your work session.
Fine. Thank you for your testimony. Questions from Representative Girard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Whose idea was this Deschutes County moving the district judge around, or the where did that come from? Why is it in this bill?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Girard, that was a bill that was actually filed in the House in 2003, passed out of the Judiciary Committee on a unanimous vote, went to Ways and Means, did not come out of Ways and Means. In 2005, Senator Westland filed a similar bill in the Senate, Senate Bill 396, and that bill has not moved forward in the process. It has not even had a hearing. So that's the genesis of this. It's been an idea the county has been promoting for at least the last two legislative sessions.
Follow, Mr. Chair? I don't know. My recollection as a county commissioner would be that this would stir up things to the point where people would be arguing over jurisdictions. Justices of the peace can hear automobile fines, speeding. I mean, this to me just opens a big door for a lot of controversy.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Girard, I can assure you the commissioners in Deschutes County are very, very supportive of the addition of this amendment. Deschutes County operates their justice court system a little differently than some other counties. for example, by county ordinance, their justice of the peace is required to be a member of the Oregon State Bar. They want to have this option of a location within the city of Bend available in the possibility that the city of Bend and the county someday decide to consolidate lower court services and provide them, they believe, more efficiently and economically. It is true the jurisdiction of the Justice Court as it stands today, you know, there is concurrent jurisdiction over minor traffic offenses with the circuit court, but in Deschutes County, for example, the state police don't cite any of their traffic cases into the Justice Court. They all go into the circuit court, which is appropriate because the revenues then flow straight into the state general fund.
But, Bill, you've got marriage licenses. You've got all kinds of things that a justice of the peace does. I mean, I'm in favor of the bill except for that part, and I would not vote for this bill with that portion still in it.
We're only here, representative, on a public hearing.
I just wanted to spot off.
No, I'm glad you did, because it tells our participants what they have to do and what information we should receive from the Deschutes County people about this. Okay, further questions? Representative Flores.
Thank you. And anyone can answer, but Mr. Marquis, I think you made reference to the fact that municipal and justice courts were out of this bill. Can you, is there some assurance or has that actually been done, and can you point me into the Dash 1 amendments where that is the case?
Mr. Chair, Representative Flores, in the amendments, the language that occurred in the original legislation from last session and also was in House Bill 3124, spoke to fees being charged by the circuit, the clerk of the circuit court, and other courts. And the term "and other courts" has been deleted from that language, and that the first time that occurs, I believe, in the amendments is on page 11, line 9. And then there are several other places, I believe, where that occurs in the amendments. Does that clarify what you're...
Follow-up.
You may.
You were referring to the Dash 1 amendments when you say clerk of the circuit court and other courts.
I'm referring to... Yes, I'm referring to the Dash 1 amendments, page 11, and what I'm saying is that on line 9, it says the clerk of the circuit court shall collect a surcharge. The language in the current law says, I believe, the clerk of the circuit court and other courts shall collect. And so that "and other courts" has been deleted, so that it would no longer apply to justice courts or municipal courts.
Thank you very much.
Further questions from the committee? Hearing none, thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you.
I'll call Representative Hansen, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll be very... very brief. And I introduced this bill early in the session when it became very clear through the Ways and Means process that we were going to have a continuing dramatic shortfall in revenue going to the courts, and that we were facing a real crisis. This bill was primarily filed as a placeholder. I was hoping, and I have been very pleasantly surprised that the various individual groups that were going to be touched by this bill were able to come together and come forward with a set of amendments to make it more workable and more more palatable to everybody included. The basics is that we'll still raise $5 million for the Judicial Department, by going directly to the judicial department operating account. It keeps day-to-day expenses of the courts running smoothly, eases the burden to the general fund, and I'm very pleased that the bill includes a clause that allows the collectors to recoup funds from the increases in court judgment. And it's already in both of the co-chairs' ways and means budgets. So I hope you continue to work the bill, smooth out the problems, any problems in it, make Representative Girard happy, if not happy, at least quiet, and move this to completion so we can have a reasonably funded judiciary by the time we go home. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative. Are there any questions from the committee? Seeing none, thank you. You're excused. Further testimony on House Bill 2912.
Chair? I think we're on 3124.
Oh, I'm sorry. 3124, you're right. Further testimony on 3124. Seeing none, I'll close the public hearing on House Bill 3124. And open a public hearing on House Bill 2203. Council?
Chair Ackerman, members of the committee, House Bill 2203 allows the state agency to adopt the Attorney General's model rules on confidentiality of mediation communications without prior approval of the governor. Originally, this bill was passed about 8 years ago to require prior approval from the governor, so that it was intended to ensure that mediation confidentiality rules were consistent with Oregon's long-standing interest in open government. Apparently, the governor has not, in the past 8 years, denied any of these agencies from adopting the Attorney General's rules. So this process by removing that requirement would allow the agencies to proceed with a little bit more efficiency.
We have one witness, Mr. Niemeyer. Would you like to come forward, please? Good morning.
Good morning. Chair Ackerman, committee members, for the record, my name is Mike Niemeyer. I'm the Alternative Dispute Resolution Coordinator for the Oregon Department of Justice. Your counsel ably summarized this bill. Just to make myself available for questions, but again, just to reiterate that this is really just an efficiency bill, that there's a provision now in law that's a little used that does require agencies to send and receive back from the governor approval prior to adoption of rules, and we've just found that in the last 8 years it really hasn't been necessary to go through that exercise, so it just seems efficient to eliminate that particular requirement, and I'm happy to answer any questions you might have on this bill.
Fine, thank you. Questions from the committee? Yes, Representative Flores.
Thank you, Mr. Niemeyer. You indicate in the past 8 years that hasn't been an issue or used. What about time prior to that? Has it been an issue? Has it been used? How often?
Chair Ackerman, Representative Flores, prior to that time, the mediation confidentiality statute didn't exist, and so it was in 1997 that Oregon passed Senate Bill 160, which modified ORS Chapter 36 and provided for very broad the availability of confidentiality in mediation for public bodies. And so prior to that time, that law just didn't exist.
Further questions? Yes, Representative Ford.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Can you tell me the agencies that have adopted the mediation confidentiality rules, is there some degree of standardization in all of them?
Jackman, Representative Worth, yes, there is, and that was the reason why under ORS 36224 that the Attorney General was to develop confidentiality rules and that then would be uniform across state agencies. And so agencies have the option of adopting one of two or both rules that we've developed. One relates to just general mediation and the other is specific to workplace disputes. And so agencies would be adopting those standardized rules. And they have the ability to make some small changes to those and they could always provide less confidentiality if an agency felt that they wanted to accept something out. So there is that level of standardization in the...
Follow-up, Mr. Chair?
Yes.
So are there any agencies out there that have adopted anything really, you know, out of the norm of up to this point?
Chair Ackerman, Representative Worth,
much more strictly
confident. No, the under the statute, agencies would not be able to adopt their own rules, but this provision, which had the governor approving adoption of rules, also had agencies indicating how those rules would be applied. And when this was originally put in the statute, we hadn't had any experience with agencies participating in confidential mediations, and so this was an opportunity really to monitor that activity to see how agencies plan to use mediation confidentiality. And as your counsel noted, the concern at that time was to make sure that it didn't have an adverse impact on open government provisions.
Thank you.
Further questions for the committee? I just have a small question, I guess, on the line 22 that the bold-faced print says now under the bill the governor can disapprove the proposed rules, whereas before he had sort of veto power. You don't mean to continue the veto power, I'm sure. I'm just worried as whether the word use of the word disapproves signifies that. I mean, what's the significance of the disapproval now that they're vetoed? I mean, the intent is not to do that. Now I'm sure we should make a record of what.
Well, Chair Ackerman, my understanding is that this would be similar to the past practice, and that the governor would have the ability to tell an agency that the governor did not want the agency to proceed with the rulemaking for whatever reason. This would just the intent here is that would shift so that the agency wouldn't need to receive prior approval, that it would be notifying the governor at the same time that it provided public notice of its rulemaking, and at that time the governor could indicate to the agency that the governor felt that was not advisable to proceed with those rules.
Okay, thank you. Further questions from the committee? Thank you for your testimony. Any further witnesses on House Bill 2203? Seeing none, then I will conclude the public hearing on House Bill 2203 and open a work session on House Bill 2203. Do we have a motion? The chair then will move that House Bill 2203 proceed to the full committee with a due pass recommendation. Discussion on the motion. Seeing no discussion, the clerk may call the roll.
Representative Flores?
Aye.
Representative Garrard?
Aye.
Representative Worth?
Aye.
Chair Ackerman?
Aye. House Bill 2203 will be forwarded to the full committee with due pass recommendation, and I'll carry the bill. And I'll close the work session on House Bill 2203 and open a public hearing on House Bill 2205. Council?
Chair Ackerman, members of the committee, House Bill 2205 allows a state agency to provide the services of an employee as a mediator or facilitator to another agency or the federal government. It also allows a state agency to use the services of another agency or employee or the federal government or a federal government employee for purposes of mediation and facilitation. This will do a couple things. It will save the agencies the expense of hiring private contractors to do these services. It will also expand the pool of mediators available to state agencies.
Thank you. I have three witnesses. I'll call them up all at once. Mr. Niemeyer, you may come back to the table. I believe there's a Francis Peterson. I'm having a little trouble reading or writing. And Ronell Schenkel.
Good morning, Chair Ackerman. For the record, Ron L. Schenkel with the Department of Justice. I am here to testify first before these two experts tell you about the bill, simply to offer my personal apologies to the committee. There are some amendments pending on this bill. They are very minor, and your council has a copy of them. But during the process of putting this bill together, we had a conversation with the Employment Relation Board and need to add one small amendment to accept their specific statute out. Because of the way that they already provide their services and work with federal mediators, and I believe Mr. Niemeyer can explain that further if need be, but I wanted to offer my apologies for not having that ready for you today.
Thank you. Mr. Niemeyer, your name has been called.
Thank you, Chair Ackerman. Again, for the record, my name is Mike Niemeyer with the Department of Justice. HB 2205 would provide the ability for us to expand an existing program which shares employees within state agencies with other agencies in appropriate cases. And I submitted written testimony. I'll allow you to go through that, and I won't reiterate what's in there. But this is a program that's been modeled after a program called Shared Neutrals at the federal level, which is operative throughout the country and has a very robust program here, which I'll allow Fran to tell you about. I believe it's a great program, and that it allows the agencies to make use of some very skilled mediators at little or no cost. And there's just a number of disputes that we've resolved over the last 2 years through the use of this resource. So at this point, I would like to introduce Fran, and with your permission, Chair, invite her to explain how the Shared Neutrals program works.
Fine. Please proceed.
Chair Ackerman, members of the committee, thanks for the opportunity to talk to you today. I am Fran Peterson, and I'm chair of the board of directors for Shared Neutrals here in Oregon and southern Washington. Shared Neutrals was formed in 1996. At this point, we have 28 public agencies that are members. They range from the City of Portland to the City and County of Vancouver, the Bureau of Land Management, U.S. Forest Service, a large variety of federal and city and county agencies. We have a halftime program coordinator. Each member agency has a liaison, and cases come up through that liaison to a program coordinator who then assigns mediators. The value of this program is that public agency staff receive a trained, qualified mediator to help them resolve their dispute, and approximately 90% of the disputes that come through this program are successfully resolved. That is familiar with working in a public agency setting, yet is a neutral, and that is essentially the value to public employees. We are able, through our system, to assign cases within 1 week. Cases generally come to the table within a month, and our estimated value of the services that are provided ranges between $1 million and $2 million a year. We field approximately 60 cases per year, and there are numerous other cases that are resolved through coaching and through the convening case, through the convening process before they actually come to the table. We're very excited about the opportunity to work with the state. Like the state, we have a roster of skilled mediators and facilitators, and we think this is a very wonderful opportunity to share resources to the benefit of the agencies that are involved and the mediators as well. So I'm happy to answer any other questions about our program in any way that can support you in your deliberation on this bill.
Fine. Thank you for your testimony. Are there questions from the committee? Okay, seeing none, you've done well. Thank you very much for your testimony. It's my intent to bring the bill into a work session this morning, forward it to the full committee with leave for you to submit your Dash 1 amendment.
Thank you, Chair Ackerman.
Okay. And with that, I will close the public hearing on House Bill 2205 and open a work session on House Bill 2205.
Mr. Chair, I'll move House Bill 2205 to the full committee with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Flores moves House Bill 2205 to the full committee with a due pass recommendation. Is there discussion on the motion? Seeing none, then the clerk will call the roll.
Representative Flores?
Aye.
Representative Garrard? Excuse me. Representative Worth?
Aye.
Chair Ackerman?
Aye. House Bill 2205 is forwarded to the full committee with a due pass recommendation, and understanding is that the proponents will have leave to submit a dash one amendment to the full committee. With that, I will close the work session on House Bill 2205. I'll open a work session on House Bill 2228. Council, can you tell us about this bill, please?
Chair Ackerman, members of the committee, House Bill 2228 specifies the form of a bond or letter of credit that is required of a mail agent. It also authorizes the Attorney General to bring an action against a mail agent to recover damages due to a person. Under current law right now, a mail agent is required to have a surety bond in the sum of $10,000. This bill does not change that. However, it does set forth the form that bond or letter of credit must be in.
Fine, thank you. I have one witness. It looks like Ross Laybourne. Please come forward.
Good morning. Chair Ackerman, members of the committee, my name is Ross Laybourne. I'm an assistant attorney general. I serve as attorney in charge of the department's charitable activities section. I apologize that I don't have written testimony for you. I was out of the office last week, and I just learned late yesterday that the bill was going to have a hearing today. I will be brief and then available for any questions that you may have. One of the things that my office does is enforce the Oregon Charitable Solicitations Act, and in particular, we're looking for those entities engaged in fraudulent or misleading charitable solicitations. Many times those are out-of-state perpetrators, but one of the things that they do in order to carry out their particular artifice is to give Oregonians the impression that they are operating a local charitable activity. And the way that they do that is they will, of course, contact the citizen through direct mail or through a telemarketing campaign. But then they will give them a return envelope with a local Oregon address, which will invariably be a local private mailbox. And typically the mailbox operator will then collect the contributions in the case of charitable solicitations, or if it was the purchase of goods or services, again, they would collect the purchase price. They will forward those envelopes then on to the out-of-state organization. When it's used in this fashion, internally, we would refer to these as mail drops, but the statute refers to them as mail agents, meaning these private mailbox operations. The legislature, I believe, recognized that there was a significant problem in this area a long time ago, and in 1991 adopted enacted a statute which you see codified at around ORS 646 that basically set out certain responsibilities for mail agents. In particular, they need to know who the tenant of the mailbox is. They need to establish that identity. If it's a business entity, they need to ensure that that entity has, if it's a corporation, registered as a foreign corporation to do business in Oregon. If it's operating under an assumed business name, register that assumed business name with the state of Oregon. The law then requires that mail agents, as counsel told you, be bonded, obtain a $10,000 bond. Also creates a private right of action for injured citizens if the mail agent doesn't carry out its duties pursuant to the existing law. House Bill 2228 that you have before you with the recommendation of the Department of Justice is intended to improve the existing law in two ways. One is that under Section 1, currently the statute just says obtain a $10,000 bond, but it doesn't have the normal language that you find throughout all of the other bonds throughout the Oregon Revised Statutes. And that language is important because it tells you who can recover against the bond, what kind of conduct is covered, who is to approve the form of the bond, and typically provides language that allows for a letter of credit as an alternative to posting a surety bond. And so what we just asked the Legislative Council to do was take that standard language from any of the other standard bonding provisions throughout the Oregon Revised Statutes and add it to this in Section 1. I frankly think that if we were to do a survey of mail agents, we would find today that few, if any, have a bond simply because there is no adequate language to tell a surety company how to produce a bond to cover these mail agents. The second change is in Section 2. We, based on the general description I gave you of what transpires in the charitable solicitation field, and I think also my colleagues in the financial fraud section would tell you that it's probably generally true with the sales of goods or services by these out-of-state entities, that typically they generate a fair amount of money, but it's typically small sums of money per individual victims. So even though there is a private right of action, it's not particularly cost-effective for an individual donor or individual consumer to seek the remedy that's currently provided under the statute. And so in keeping with the spirit of, say, the Oregon Unlawful Trade Practices Act, in Section 2, this simply allows the Attorney General to be able to seek restitution on behalf of injured victims for any mail agent who creates a loss to those donors or consumers who, in the course of their activity, violates their current responsibilities under the mail agent law. And so with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions of the committee.
Fine. Thank you for your testimony. Other questions from the committee? Seeing none, well done. Thank you very much. Further witnesses to testify on House Bill 2228. Seeing none, I will close the public hearing on House Bill 2228 and open a work hearing on House Bill 2228. Do I have a motion?
Mr. Chair, I'll move House Bill 2228 to the full committee with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Worth moves that House Bill 2228 proceed to the full committee with a due pass recommendation. Is there discussion on the motion? Seeing none, then the clerk may call the roll.
Representative Flores?
Aye.
Representative Garrard?
Aye.
Representative Worth?
Aye.
Chair Ackerman?
Aye. House Bill 2228 is forwarded to the full committee with a due pass recommendation with Representative Worth as a carrier. And with that, I'll close the work session on House Bill 2228. And is there any further business to come before the committee this morning? Seeing none, we're adjourned.